Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What we had here was a real estate boom that became a financial crisis that turned into a global recession. All the while, there has been one relative constant in the economic equation. What all those assets that went bad are worth? We still don't know, but today we got some new rules that might help us figure it out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is the 2nd of April. It's a Thursday, and it is good to have you with us. I'm going to have to do something here that we try really hard to avoid. Hit you with one of those phrases that Wall Street insiders like to throw around as if it's the key to all knowledge, which, in this case, it might actually be. Mark-to-market accounting. It's a lot more simple than it sounds, as Amy Scott's going to tell us in a minute. But it's also pretty high on the list of things some people think are responsible for the financial part of this economic crisis. Today, the folks who get to make up the rules on how companies keep their books eased back on marking to market. Here's Amy.
Let's say you own a house. If you want to know how much it's worth, you see what people are paying for similar houses down the block. That's mark-to-market accounting, putting a value on something based on what the market will pay. Of course, you might think your house is worth a lot more than the market does right now. Banks feel the same way about some of their mortgage-backed securities. Today, the Financial Accounting Standards Board voted to give banks more leeway in saying what some of those securities are worth. John Gavin runs Disclosure Insight, a research service for investors. He calls the decision a disappointment.
If a company can essentially make up whatever numbers they want, that really compromises the integrity of those disclosures.
So why have bank stocks been going up since the accounting board first announced its proposal a few weeks ago? Analyst Stuart Plesser follows the industry for Standard & Poor's. He says investors seem to think bank earnings will look a lot stronger now, but he says those banks may be more inclined to report losses if they're not as bad.
Ironically, this might even result in more impairment charges coming out.
The ruling today could also hurt the Treasury Department's efforts to get banks to unload their troubled assets to investors.
It kind of neuters Secretary Geithner's plan.
That's Dan Ripp. He's president of research firm Bradley Woods & Company. Ripp says if banks don't have to take heavy losses on their mortgage bonds, they may just hold on to them.
There's a disincentive for banks to sell those securities at depressed prices when they can keep them on their balance sheets at higher prices by virtue of the new ruling.
Ripp agrees the accounting rules need to be fixed to more accurately portray what banks have on their books. But he says the timing of the new rule may prolong the pain. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There were few surprises at the G20 meeting over in London today. The communique from the leaders of the world's 20 largest economies was pretty much what we all saw coming. Tougher financial regulation, a crackdown on tax havens, tighter controls over hedge funds, and more along those lines. But there was one thing that stood out, a huge increase in the International Monetary Fund's bank account. The IMF will have $750 billion to play with and what looks to be a new lease on life. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The IMF is the big winner in the summit. It's been given a new role, savior of the global economy. The body will get $750 billion worth of public cash. That includes $250 billion worth of its own special money that it can print itself. It will then offer short-term loans to countries that get into trouble. Most observers were astonished at this upswing in the IMF's fortunes, but not Simon Johnson, the body's former chief economist.
In order to fight a global crisis, you've got to work with what you've got. You've got the IMF. The IMF was short on cash before, and now it's got plenty of money to lend out.
But the IMF has to live down a legacy of distrust and fear. Economist Andrew Hilton says the body is still regarded as little better than a loan shark in the developing world. It's widely hated there for some of its previous lending practices.
It would apply exactly the same solution to every single problem. Cut government spending, fire people, lay off workers, make life grim for everyone who lives in the country, and then we'll give you a bit of money.
IMF supporters say the organization is now more sensitive and constructive in its approach. Sarah Edwards of the Jubilee Debt Campaign is not convinced.
And we're worried that new money will, in fact, potentially have some of the same damaging effects as the lending that the IMF has carried out in the past.
But such is the scale of the current crisis that most of the IMF's new customers are likely to be middle-income countries in the developed world. An East European country like Poland could be an early client. Mexico has already applied for a loan. The new beefed-up IMF is going to be a busy, and say its supporters, responsible lender. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Just in case you didn't get your fill of global economic crisis management this time, rest easy. The G20 is going to meet again this coming November. Same general topic, I'd guess. Here's how those new mark-to-market rules look to traders, like cash on the barrelhead for some very big and very troubled banks. That and the generally optimistic tone that's been out there the past couple of weeks added to the tear that Wall Street has been on. We will have the details when we do the numbers. President Obama has really been making the rounds over in London. His schedule today was packed with meetings, both the actual G20 summit and one-on-ones with a handful of other leaders, including Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. Their conversation turned mostly on geopolitics, Pakistan, and nuclear weapons. But over the past 20 years or so, the Indian economy has become a force of its own. Nandan Nilekani is the co-chairman of Infosys. That's one of the big Indian IT companies. He's also the author of a new book called Imagining India. And when we spoke, I asked him how India has been doing so far in this global recession.
India in particular, while it is affected by this downturn, it really doesn't have some of the fundamental challenges or problems in the banking system or poor regulation. In some sense, India has the potential to recover earlier than many countries in the world once the recovery starts.
We haven't really talked about the political side of the Indian economy. You live in a very rough neighborhood of the world. Geopolitics is a big factor in India and in the U.S.-Indian relationship. Is that an issue in how quickly or fully the Indian economy might develop?
Certainly, I think we do have challenges on some of our borders, and it has the potential to disrupt what's happening in India. But fundamentally, I think the inherent economic strength of the billion people, the demographic dividend, the huge diversity of entrepreneurs that we have, the democracy, all these things, I believe, are truly compelling arguments as to why once the crisis is over in the world, India will go back to very decent rates of growth.
Interesting phrase, demographic dividend, because, there is a certain demographic burden that comes with India and a billion people in various states of social development. But another phrase for it might be human capital, right?
Yes. In fact, I think the big change in India is that over the last 40 years, we have gone from seeing a population as a burden to population as human capital. And the demographic dividend in particular arises because population growth rates have slowed down. And so we'll have a huge hump of people in the working age of 15 to 65, which is typically when economies grow very rapidly.
Is it something specific to technology that has made the Indian economy as powerful as it is? I mean, is there big manufacturing and do you rely on those kinds of things as well?
Well, technology has been an important part. It's, it's about a $50 billion industry in a $1 trillion economy. But more importantly, the technology was the first sector to take off after the economic reforms and therefore, in some sense, provided a role model for other industries. So you're seeing a lot of innovation now in manufacturing and hopefully soon in agriculture, too.
That rise in the Indian technology sector, though, came at the expense of a little bit of political blowback here in the United States. I mean, there were problems and worries about call centers being outsourced. And if you had a computer problem, you never knew if you were talking to somebody in New Delhi or in Michigan. I mean, it was a very big issue here.
Clearly, outsourcing is there. And I guess in an environment where the economy grows slowly and there are less jobs around, it has the potential to become a political issue. But I do believe that it's very much required. It's part of free trade in a global economy. India imports, for example, billions of dollars of computers, of mobile phones, of planes from countries like the U.S. So really, I think if we keep both economies going, it's a two-way street.
Let me ask you to try to put yourself in the mind of the American reader of this book. It's called Imagining India. And I'm wondering what you think American readers currently imagine India as.
There is a lot of sort of ambiguity about what India is. And my purpose in writing this book for the global reader is to really explain India's contradictions and complexities, at the same time paint a picture of how India can do well. And I think India doing well is very important for the U.S. because this is one-sixth of humanity. The future of the world in terms of global warming will be decided by how countries like India and China embrace the post-carbon economy. So really, there are many, many dimensions of what's happening in India and its future.
Nanda Nilekani is the co-chairman of Infosys Technologies, one of India's leading information technology firms. His new book is called Imagining India. Mr. Nilekani, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
State and local governments across the country are getting the ball rolling on spending federal stimulus money. A lot of it's going for new public construction. That's a fancy way of saying infrastructure projects like repaving roads, widening interstates, and retrofitting schools and government buildings. Colorado has just opened its first bidding for road and bridge repairs. And Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports that some states might actually get a good deal.
I caught up with Stacy Stegman of the Colorado Department of Transportation just as her office was finishing up the first round of bidding for federally funded road work.
We actually physically open the envelopes and then identify who the apparent low bidder is.
Colorado handed out $30 million in contracts today, from repaving roads in downtown Denver to repairing I-70 on the way to Vail. Stegman says it's not yet clear how many new jobs contractors will create.
Some now are going to start hiring. Others have employees that they've laid off now that they're going to be able to bring back. And then others were on the verge of having to lay off employees that won't have to go now.
With $140 billion flowing to the states, you'd think contractors would be in high demand and could bid up the price of the work. Well, in a normal economy, maybe, but with so many projects on hold or canceled, contractors are hungry for business, says Scott Pattison. He heads up the National Association of State Budget Officers.
There's a pent-up capacity and demand. There are a lot of folks in the infrastructure and construction industries available for work.
That's exactly what Colorado officials discovered this morning. Stacy Stegman says more bidders came in than usual, and the bids were lower than expected.
An average of 12% under the engineer's estimate. So we should have some good bid savings there so that we'll be able to even add more projects in if it continues.
Colorado still has about $370 million to spend on public works. It looks like taxpayers will get a lot of concrete and asphalt for their money. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And now, let's do the numbers. Nothing but sweetness and light on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials raced ahead 216 points, 2.75%, ended at 79.78. It was above 8,000 at one point. The NASDAQ jumped 51 points, 3.25%, closed at 1602. The S&P 500 sprinted up 24 points, 3%, finished at 835. That trillion-dollar promise from the G20 to support the International Monetary Fund helped, as did that mark-to-market decision that Amy Scott was telling us about. Goldman Sachs added 3.5%. Wells Fargo, the second-largest mortgage lender in these United States, gained nearly 6%. Bank of America advanced 2.7%. But Morgan Stanley fell 2.6% today. That after one analyst revised his first-quarter estimate for the bank to a loss from a modest profit. Companies that depend on discretionary spending by consumers got a boost. Broadcast powerhouse CBS charged up 20%. The 10-year T-note fell, that is, prices on it did. The yield rose to 2.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on fallout from the financial crisis, watch the Marketplace whiteboards, and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
on the Marketplace. Dave Book, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases unemployment figures for March. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke talks about the Fed's balance sheet at a symposium in Charlotte, North Carolina. And on April 3, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous mountain speech in Memphis, Tennessee. He was assassinated the next day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl with something we haven't talked a lot about lately, an initial public offering on the NASDAQ. Today, an online game company from China, Changyo, it's called, went public. Did pretty well, too. The Asian gaming industry is still somehow managing to thrive despite the global recession. It's a business model that has some Western rivals envious, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
23-year-old Shuja is an office worker by day. By night, she's a dancing queen, at least in the virtual world. Every evening, she and tens of millions of Chinese go online to play computer games, like this one, Audition. It's a digital disco where Shuja's character boogies to the keystrokes. Her friends are wired too, so their characters join in. Now, if you're okay with a virtual dancer that looks generic, the game is free. But Shuja's sports a low-cut, body-hugging Catwoman number. And to dress her character this way, Shuja has to pay the game company real-world money.
I can buy my character clothes I wouldn't dare to wear in real life. Girls may not be able to dance in real life, or they may not be beautiful, but all that can happen in online games.
Every month, Shu spends about $6 to be the hot girl.
If you want jewelry, like a ring, you need to pay. Then, if you hook up with a guy dancer and get extra points, your ring gets prettier.
If all this strikes you as weird, remember, the real people playing these online games are fueled by real forces like vanity and peer pressure. Game developer James Jen.
All the things that drive purchases in the real world, your ego, your appearance, or how you appear to other people, you know, greed, envy, revenge, you know, all of these are very strong motivators.
The sale of these virtual items has China's game sector thriving. Revenue grew 76% last year. This fighting game was designed by Changyo.com, the company that's debuting on NASDAQ. To reach a certain level, you need good weapons. Pay up. Other games let you own a digital pet. You just have to fork out real money to pay the vet. Jen says all this profit potential has the online game industry buzzing.
In Shanghai, it's the only place in the world where every single game company has offices here. Everyone is trying to understand this Chinese game phenomenon and how to monetize it.
It's not totally Chinese. Korean firms are in the space too. But mobile game developer Frank Yu says the point is the Asian companies are years ahead of American firms in finding ways to monetize the web.
Look at Facebook. Facebook's pretty large, but they're still struggling to make a profit. It's almost like when Japanese car manufacturers came to the U.S. after the U.S. got complacent in terms of car design.
So how did China get a head start in turning online fun into a money-making industry? Well, for one thing, the internet here has been the go-to place for entertainment since day one. The alternatives just don't cut it.
You know what? Traditional media, television, and movies, I've been here long enough, I can say that's pretty bad.
That's Sam Fleming of the internet consulting firm CIC. He says China's one-child policy means millions of young people have no siblings. So when they play, it's online.
The internet is very, very social. I would say it's social and entertaining before it's about information.
As web life has evolved in China, so have web game makers. They've honed the art of luring folks in, addicting them, and then selling them stuff. Now, Frank Yu says these Chinese firms want to take the model global and go after American gamers. And in the process, they want to acquire U.S. game companies, who produce some of the snazziest products in the world.
There's a lot of very talented people in studios in Seattle and Austin. You know, Chinese companies want to cherry pick with the best values they can purchase because of the recession, almost at a bargain.
And just maybe, buying those American companies can help bridge a massive culture gap. But no one thinks it'll be easy. Just ask all the U.S. firms who came to China and botched it several times themselves before they got it right. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The digitization of healthcare took another step forward today. General Electric and Intel said they're working together on a way to let doctors monitor their patients remotely, checking their vital signs or even reminding them to take their medicines. Kathleen Sebelius, the president's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services, said this week the administration wants Americans to have electronic health records by 2014. Commentator and physician Peter Box suggests it's the step after that that's going to make all the difference.
President Obama knows that the handwritten notes and manila folders that doctors use to keep your medical records have to go. The stimulus package, at his urging, includes $19 billion to help doctors buy computer systems for their offices. But electronically connecting these systems to one another so that your medical records are available to any doctor who is treating you is what will dramatically improve patient care. And that step is going to be much harder. You might think interconnectivity isn't that important, but imagine this. In aggregate, the patients of one primary care doctor in the U.S. see 228 other doctors in 117 other medical practices each year. There's no way that a single doctor can keep track of all these other doctors' actions with faxes, photocopies, and phone calls. So, errors are made, expensive tests get reordered, and costs just go up and up. Getting doctors interconnected could fix the problem, but there are some roadblocks ahead. No one agrees on the proper data format. 4 years of lollygagging public-private standards committees haven't fixed that. The layers of privacy and security to protect records have not been totally defined. Most important, doctors and hospitals don't want it to happen. After all, they've spent a lot of money getting you as a patient, buying ads in the newspaper and creating their brand. You are a revenue-generating asset, made stickier because your records are in their possession. They don't want you to go to another doctor who might be better or cheaper. Hanging on to your records means hanging on to you. Once records are standardized, what doctors do can be easily looked at too. Those that order too many tests or fail to practice up-to-date care will stand out. Competition over price will drive down doctors' incomes. And the old excuse for repeating a test, "I just didn't have the results from the other doctor," will go away. So, let's remember that whether or not there's a computer in every doctor's office is not what matters. It's what it's wired to that does.
Peter Bach is a physician at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. He used to be an advisor to the head of Medicare and Medicaid. You can send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. Newspapers, as we know, are having more than their share of problems, falling circulation and ad revenues going the same way. Less well-known, but remarkably similar, is how clobbered magazines have been. And while there is always the supermarket checkout line to help us keep tabs on what Britney's doing, Us Weekly, Star, and all the rest simply aren't selling as many copies. That doesn't only mean thinner magazines and less coverage of B-list celebrities. It means less work for the paparazzi who snap their every move. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins caught up with the people behind the flashbulbs.
Raul Guerra spends hours staring into the sunglasses of nameless Angelenos.
Those are nobodies. They're not even important for their moms.
Guerra's looking for people who'll sell magazines. Maybe it's Jennifer Aniston and her ex-boyfriend John Mayer in an embrace. Or better yet, in a screaming match. Or the get of a lifetime, Jen and her ex-husband Brad Pitt in an embrace, followed by Brad and Angie in a screaming match. Today, though, it's none of those.
That's a guy from the Rolling Stones. You're getting up.
It's Ron Wood, aging guitarist for the Rolling Stones. Rumor has it he left his wife, and the woman he's with is very young.
Hey, Ron, some more pictures, please. There you go. Thank you.
A few years ago, a shot like that might be worth thousands. Today, a couple hundred, if anything. Ron's not worth what he used to be, but then again, neither are the younger stars. In the past few months, Guerra says his income has dropped as much as 40%, and he's never sure what will sell.
You'd be surprised. Sometimes, like, oh, hey, fine, this is a nice picture. You're happy at the end of the day, but next morning you know that he didn't sell. So it's unpredictable to say really what they want right now.
They are the celebrity magazines. People, Us Weekly, Star, and they've upended the paparazzi business. They switched a few years ago from running only shots of celebs doing glamorous things to using shots of stars doing everything, like picking up after the dog or getting the dry cleaning. The market for paparazzi photos exploded. Ben Evanstead runs the agency that sells Raul Guerra's shots.
So after that, there was kind of this gold rush period where a ton of people got into the business.
With so many pictures on the market, prices started to drop. Then the recession hit. Fewer people bought magazines, advertisers cut back, revenues took a dive.
A year ago, the magazines wouldn't argue over $50 or $100 difference. Now, if you can't meet their price, they'll drop the photo.
Meanwhile, the price of being a paparazzo is still high. You need top-notch cameras, a car that can handle a chase, and a Rolodex full of informants. You also need a fat travel budget to get the real money shots, like Chris Brown and Rihanna making amends at a secluded location. Bonnie Fuller's the former editor of Us Weekly. Her idea to run pictures of celebrities acting just like us, you know, the whole dry cleaning thing, helped double the magazine's newsstand sales. But these days, she says it's the big stories that really sell magazines.
You know, you get something new, you're going to excite the audience, and they're going to run out to the newsstand.
Fuller says experienced paparazzi will stay in the business. Raul Guerra says he already has an exit strategy. He's taking night classes, working toward a graphic design degree. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of, I'm not quite sure they really get it. You know those in-flight magazines that airlines offer? The ones you pick up to help pass the time only when you've read everything you've brought on board with you or when you want to see what the movie is, the one where somebody else has done the crossword puzzle? Delta Airlines said this week it's going to start offering its magazine on newsstands. $3.99 will get you the latest copy of Sky Magazine. You are on your own for peanuts and a soda, though. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow climbed 216 points, 2.75% to close at 79.78. The NASDAQ added 51 points, 3.25%, ended at 16.02. The S&P 500 gained 24 points, 3%, finished at 8.35. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, how pawn shops are having trouble cashing in on the recession.
A lot of the bigger shops, they have signs on their doors that they're out of cash, can't make any more loans. It gets very tricky in the economy like this.
Pawn shops out of cash, go figure that one out. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.